Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. Today is October 12th, 2025. Can you believe it? And we are in the middle of, yes, it has come back, Columbus Day. Columbus Day weekend. Let's have a small celebration for Chris.
Yay!
He's back. Italians everywhere are celebrating. So in their honor. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff.
I always make you say your name after so you can own everything I say.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, you can't disclaim. Oh my gosh. Well, so last week we had a little bungle on the guest situation, but we're going to try it again this week, and we have a fail-safe plan. So just going to announce my fail-safe plan in case it doesn't work. I just want you to know I had one. All right, so first hour, we are talking about the Proposition 50 campaign here in California. So if you are somewhere other than California and you're thinking, oh, who cares about that? You do super care about it because the crazy stuff that's happening here, well, always goes there. And the other part of it is Gavin Newsom wants to run for president, so you can get a little sneak peek behind the curtain just in case you're not watching the news and find out the kind of stuff he does in case you were conflicted and thought you should elect him because he had good hair or something. Which seems to be a criteria, and that is...
Oh, he's got good hair.
And that is perplexing to me, because I think his hair is scary, and I think he looks like a vampire. But, okay. So, full disclosure. It's Full Disclosure Sunday in honor of Christopher Columbus. Second hour, we're going to make a run again with Alan Gulslow. I've got to look at it, how you pronounce it again. Darn it, I lost my note. And why are Americans ignorant of our own history? So, anyway, failsafe is we're going to keep Mark Moisher as a hostage for the second hour in case Alan bails on us again. And I did tell him that this is not the first time he has heard it. So, our guest, Mark Moisher, is not knocking at the door, but someone else is. He is an attorney with the Dillon Law Group. He's been there since 2017. He's a passionate advocate for justice, renowned for his ability to challenge powerful adversaries and uphold the rights of the underrepresented. And who's in? Oh, it's Robert. Hi, Robert. Robert Exter, the guy who does our archives. Three cheers for Robert. Okay. Whether facing Fortune 500 companies, government agencies, or entrenched political interests, Mark's practice is anchored in the principle that scales of justice should remain balanced, regardless of the opposition's resources. And I got to tell you, Mark can pack more information into 5 minutes than pretty much anybody else, except maybe the guy we speak to about economics periodically whose name eludes me, but he's a pretty fast talker too, but you're going to learn a lot this hour. So we're going to learn kind of what Prop 50 is about. There are a lot of people who don't know what's happening, don't know what it is, and are not sure if yes means yes or yes means no. So we're going to decode all that. And if you're smart, you're voting no, but bottom line, we'll spoiler alert it at the front end. Mr. Moisha, how goes it?
How we doing?
How goes it in the once great state of California?
You know, California is still a great state. It's just being run by some pretty pathetic politicians.
Yeah, exactly. Can you go just a teensy bit closer to your microphone?
Is that better?
Ooh, yes, that's much better.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
No problem. We definitely have a lot to cover over the next hour or two.
Oh,
and
Lord, yes.
You know, that's some pretty high praise that you gave me of what I can do in 5 minutes. Imagine what we're going to do in an hour.
Oh, that's why I was kind of warning them. I mean, every time, because you have popped in on different meetings that I've been in, especially up here in the North State, and people are like, that guy knows a lot of stuff. I got to go home and think about that. I'm like, well, that's high praise.
Well, you know, hey, we get around, but this Prop 50 is, you know, pretty scary stuff. And I know this about me, but most of your listeners probably don't. I like to travel, you know, when I'm not in court litigating or running for office, I do like to travel the world, and I like to do Ironman races around the world. And
I forgot about that. That's right.
And in August, I was supposed to go to Estonia, And next weekend, I was supposed to be in Lisbon. And when Prop 50 came down and I saw what they were trying to do, I was like, ooh. I actually canceled two international trips just to stay down here and see what we could do to try to defeat this Prop 50 in the courthouse if necessary, but the ballot box preferably.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's the tidiest and has the least, you know. I mean, it's there's always that danger when we involve the courts that there's a fumble on the play and we wind up, you know, tangled in the rope. Where would you like to begin with this? I know the story about Texas is very long and cumbersome. Can we do like the elevator version or maybe how about the 10-minute version, because we got 10 minutes till a break and we can kind of get that Texas thing figured out? Because, I mean, bottom line, I think most people who oppose Prop 50 think gerrymandering is wrong. Not a fan of whatever Texas is doing. However, Texas really is disconnected from us in a lot of ways because they don't have the same constitutional protections that we do on the drawing of the lines and who draws the lines and when they draw the lines.
Well, apparently we don't have any constitutional protections either.
Apparently the legislature's in charge of that. So I don't know how you want to attack that, but maybe you could give folks at least help them so when their friends come at them with that, they have something smart to say.
Well, let's start with, for those people who have not received any text, have not received any mail, have not heard anything on the radio.
Oh, that's true. Let's go with them. Yeah.
Prop 50. Let's start with why we even need to talk about text.
That's
true. And that is because Gavin Newsom and the Democrat Party are saying that this is a response to Donald Trump and Texas. They have put forth this proposition that Donald Trump is this evil human being, and he's trying to destroy democracy, and he told Texas to redistrict, and because Texas redistricted, now California needs to redistrict, do a mid-decade redistricting in order to counter what Texas has done. And so the political narrative by Gavin Newsom to try to rally his base, because understand, his base naturally does not like politicians picking their voters. His base generally does not like the concept of gerrymandering. His base likes the commission. And what he is asking his base to do is the exact opposite of what their natural voting tendency would be. And so in order to get his voters, his strongest supporters, to do something that they would not naturally want to do, he is having to create a lie. And that lie, that gaslighting to the people of California is, we have to do this because Trump is destroying democracy. It is Trump derangement syndrome. He has realized that Trump derangement syndrome is so strong with his base that he needs to sell this Prop 50 as the anti-cure for everything that Trump is doing. And in order to, now that we have established what Gavin Newsom is doing, now over this next hour, we need to systematically go through all the various aspects, whether it's Nancy Pelosi, whether it's Texas, and actually educate the voters of how it is a lie that Texas, you know, was doing something because Trump told them to do it. Or, you know, and that, you know, Nancy Pelosi has been a major funder trying to destroy the commission for years. And so we got a lot to unpack here, but you keep bringing up Texas. And
and before we leave that opening salvo, So when this was approved by 61% of the voters to have congressional districts drawn by a citizens commission rather than the legislators, I do have a list posted. It's connected on the website for today's show. So let's see, today's October 12th, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us, just so I don't leave you in suspense here. But some of the names, AARP, Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce, League of Women Voters, ACLU, NAACP. I mean, these are not conservatives that back the idea of taking away the ability to draw districts and put it in the hands of a citizens commission. I mean, this was, you know, ostensibly a pretty left-leaning group of folks who supported that. And now it's like, nope, we have to save democracy, so forget everything we said before.
It's basically, you know, Trump derangement syndrome. I think it's even greater than that. If you really want to get to what the root is for why those organizations have done a complete 180, it is probably a lot to do with what Trump did with Doge really early on, where the USAID, you know, he's cut off the funding to a lot of these NGOs that have funded money to these liberal organizations. And this is, you know, their way of trying to get back at Trump and try to maybe regain the funding of American taxpayer dollars that they somehow think that they are entitled to. These organizations seem to think that they can get fat on the taxpayer's dime at a time when we have record deficits. And so, you know, their solution is Trump derangement syndrome, or, you know, an all-out attack on Trump. And as such, you basically are seeing these leftist organizations who disguise themselves in neutral-sounding names. We are seeing these organizations show their real color and show that there actually is no principle to their positions that they took 10, 15 years ago, that they will sacrifice good policy for political expediency.
Yeah, so it's not about what's good for California. It has nothing to do with what's good for the constituents of California. It's all about Trump, which really is, I don't know, it's definitely deranged.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't want to get into Texas because we're starting to come close on to the break, so we'll have to save Texas discussion after the break. But I think for your listeners, the most important thing to understand why they need to vote no on Proposition 50 is because what Proposition 50 does is it ensures that Bay Area coastal elites dictate who the congressional representative is for the North State region. Because if you think that the farmers in the North State have the same desire for a congressman as the coastal elite, I got a bridge I'd like to sell you that goes to Hawaii. It's a 4-lane bridge, just so you know.
Well, and let's go even farther. The guy that will represent those far northern counties, Modoc, Lassen, Siskiyou, Shasta, all the way down to Sausalito. In some places, it's only 3 miles wide, so that seems super fair. And I really hope you go look at the map. It is the green district at the top of the state. It has a long, long elephant trunk runs along the coastal section to pick up population. And that guy is Jared Huffman. Jared Huffman is not just a, hey, I don't believe in God, but go ahead and do whatever you're going to do. He is a hardcore atheist. Who just lambasted, and I believe it was the Secretary of Transportation, in a hearing for having a picture of Jesus in his office. And he flew into a rage in a hearing about that. It's like, okay. He also was the attorney for the Natural Resource Defense Council that helped take the water away from the Central Valley in addition to other places. So if people in Northern California think they're going to get help with wolves and water and other resource issues, wrong guy.
You're basically saying that, you know, what they've done is they've taken the congressional district that generally represented the ranchers, the farmers, in the north part of California, and they divided it in two and made sure that two different Bay Area individuals will make, be doing the representation of the farmers. And there's just this particular plan, Prop 50, is designed to ensure that you don't have representation. I mean, down in Orange County, which should have four congressmen, Gavin Newsom split it into eight different ways to ensure that Los Angeles County and San Diego County pick the congressman for Orange County. You go out to the Central Valley, you know, really agricultural area, and several of the congressmen are basically being, are going to be, you know, Bay Area people representing the Central Valley. They did a number of, with this map to make sure that the, you know, big city elites are dictating coverage or dictating representatives across the state. You know, Inland Empire has the same problem. And it's just, these maps were drawn to make sure that the rural voters of California do not have a say in who they're representing.
Yeah, and people could say, well, other people can run against them. They should just win in an election. The problem is, when you do the math, they're unwinnable seats by anyone outside of the Democratic Party. The District 2 at the top of the state, which should be District 1, but whatever, isn't its District 2.
That's just one of Gavin Newsom's five constitutional violations regarding Prop 50.
Yeah. And so while he was doing that, I mean, that's a Democrat plus 25. I think it leans 25. So, like, no one's going to, I mean, you're not going to have a formidable candidate, and you can't win it. So these are all but done, which for a bunch of people who are concerned about, you know, representation and fairness and all those fun things, I guess we don't care about it as long as we, as long as we're fighting Donald Trump. Bizarre. So, I told you I had a million songs about lying and stuff, so we're gonna zoom in on those today. Our guest is Mark Moisher, and we're talking about Prop 50 and the legal aspects of it. We're gonna come back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at
wethepeopleradio.us.
People think I'm crazy, cause I worry all the time. If you paid attention, you'd be worried too. Just kill you. I could be wrong now, but I don't think so, cause there's a jungle out there. There's a jungle out there. There's a jungle out there.
Sorry about that, guys. I pulled up an extra song just in case you didn't send me one, and I hit the wrong song. So
I like it. It's still true. And it fits. If it was some kind of happy song, we'd have to say, hey, that was fake. But no, that's a good accident. And we will get into some of the money on this, because the popular, story out there is that, oh, the Republicans are dumping a ton of money and the left is just trying to catch up. Yeah. I'm sure Mark will like to laugh about that later. Or now.
Political propaganda.
Ah, yes. So much, so little time. All righty. So, what do you think they should know at this point?
Well, I think we should move on to Texas, because we've kind of teased that enough. So let's do the history of why Texas redistricted it. So we got to go back in time to way, way, way back in time. And I mean, I'm talking, we got to go way back in time to the year 2021. And in 2021, we had the census data came out, and every state was required to redistrict their congressional races. And Texas picked up a couple seats, and they had to, you know, redraw the lines in Texas. California had to redraw the lines, and we had a commission that spent thousands of hours listening to public testimony and then drew the lines. Texas drew the lines. You know, Florida drew the lines. You know, Pennsylvania drew the lines. Massachusetts drew the line. Everybody had to draw their congressional district. Now, at the same time that, you know, every state is redrawing the lines, every county has to redraw their lines for county representation. You know, and so in Shasta, you have to redraw the line for county supervisor. Down in, Sacramento, they have to redraw the lines for county supervisors. Well, in Galveston County, Texas, they had to redraw the lines for commissioners. And they drew the lines, and they decided, you know what, we're not even going to look at the race of the voters and draw these lines. We're just going to do a, you know, where are the voters, let's draw the lines that make the most amount of sense based upon where people live.
And just by the numbers, because it's a numbers, yeah. Always a numbers game to get all the, you know, all the districts are supposed to be, you know, mostly the same.
Well, Joe Biden and the Department of Justice sued Galveston County, Texas. And they said, you were supposed to create a voting rights district. And you were to create the voting rights district by taking the Latinos clear over here in this section of the county and the black voters over in this portion of the county, and you were to create a coalition district. You're supposed to gerrymander the district in order to ensure that these two minority groups had the ability to join together to elect a representative that was their color. Now, I don't know how you do that because you're drawing two different coalitions, but, you know, to create these coalition districts, but that is what Joe Biden sued over. That lawsuit went all the way to the Fifth Circuit en banc panel. And the Fifth Circuit en banc panel said, no, 30 years ago, we had this decision, and where we said that you were supposed to draw these coalition districts if you could under the Voting Rights Act. And since that time, our sister circuits in the Fourth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit have said that that's unconstitutional. And we're now looking at our case law, and we realize as a court, we were an overactive judiciary. We were a legislating judiciary when we made that decision back in the 80s. And we are overturning that decision because now that we look at the original intent of the 14th Amendment, which is an equal protection clause, and we actually look at the language of the Voting Rights Act, we do not think that you are allowed to draw lines with race in mind, and that is what you're doing when you're drawing these coalition districts where you're gerrymandering seats in order to ensure that multiple minority groups as a coalition are somehow able to elect a representative. Now, let me tell you what that is and strip all the legalese out. Basically, what the old Fifth Circuit decision was, You are required to draw seats that are going to elect Democrats. That is what they were using these coalition districts is it was an effort to ensure that you drew a seat that guaranteed a Democrat was elected regardless of what the natural population would have voted. And so as a result of that Fifth Circuit decision that said, hey, we got to step back. We got to stop being judicial activists. We're going to overturn that decision. And as such, we are now saying that coalition districts are unconstitutional. We're going with what other courts have done. We're going back to original intent. Well, the problem is in 2021, when Texas drew their line, they drew four congressional coalition districts. So these four lines are now technically unconstitutional. And so my former boss, Harmeet Dhillon, who became the head of the civil rights at DOJ, when she was sworn in, one of the first things she did is she wrote a letter to Greg Abbott and the Republican Party and said, what are you going to do? Do I have to sue you, or are you just going to take care of this problem? Because you now have four congressional districts in your state that were drawn with race in mind. And these four districts are hideous looking. One of them I call backward C. It kind of goes, it starts at Fort Worth and kind of goes over Dallas and kind of comes around the side of Dallas and then back underneath. It's a huge backward C. It's a very narrow district, but it covers a whole lot of real estate, because what they're doing is they're just picking up these black and Hispanic districts all over the place in order to create a district like that. There's another one, I think it's north of Houston. It's hideous. The way I describe it is you start on the clock at like 1 o'clock, and you run kind of down in a triangle to 6 o'clock, then in kind of a straight line up to about 10 o'clock, and then you come across back to noon, and then you just shoot straight out for a long ways, and then you do kind of this panhandle down. I mean, it was a very grotesque district that is very clearly being drawn to select minority groups so that you can ensure that Democrats have a safe seat. And I actually don't even want to say Democrats. I want to say the lobbyists have a safe seat. Because when you create districts that are guaranteed to elect a person based upon their color, what that means is that the lobbyists are able to go in and they are able to control who runs for that seat, who wins that seat in the primary, because it's, you know, at that point in time, whoever wins in the primary is guaranteed to win. And yeah. So these are not necessarily representatives. These of the people, they become representative of special interest. And the people who run and hold these seats are some of the most obnoxious, some of the most partisan politicians.
Don't forget entitled.
In D.C. yeah. And so we had a problem with these four congressional districts. And Texas, under threat of lawsuit, went in there and they fixed these lawsuits. Now, what happens when you stop drawing lines based upon race, and you start drawing the lines based upon the voters in the area? Well, in one of these districts, right next to it was Crenshaw's seat down in Houston. And he had a seat where Trump won, I think, by like 25 points. And you had a Democrat seat where, you know, the Democrats are going to win by like 15 points. Well, when you start massaging those two districts together, all of a sudden, you end up with two Republican seats, and actually, instead of having a seat where the Republican or the Democrat is guaranteed to win by huge margins, you now all of a sudden have two Republican seats that lean Republican, but Republicans by 5 points or 5-7 points. And so they are now more competitive, which means that there is a less of an opportunity for special interest to control the race, and more of an opportunity for the voters of the state of Texas to actually dictate their representation. So what naturally happened when you got rid of these four coalition districts is that they took the super red seats beside it and made them less super red, but they took these absolute grotesque gerrymandered seats and made them slightly lean Republican seat, and that just naturally happened based upon the voting patterns of the people in the area, and that when you stop drawing these underlying districts that are 5 miles wide.
Yeah, they just look like big squiggles. I mean, you know, you literally have people, at any given point in time, you're going to have people across the street from each other in different districts. That stuff happens because you got to draw a line somewhere. But these were literally snaked through communities just to pick up people based on demographic, which seems kind of contrived.
But, Mark, wait a second. Texas picked up 5 Republican seats. And you're talking about 4 districts. What happened on this 5th one? Well, this is a little bit of politics. You know, since they're redrawing the line, there happened to be a district kind of in the San Antonio area that because of the swing in the Hispanic vote, it had been a safe Democrat seat, and it was becoming a toss-up seat as a result of the changing demographic and voting patterns of Hispanics. And so since they were redrawing the lines, the Republicans were in charge, and they said, hey, we're going to spend millions of dollars trying to flip the seat. We're at the process right now. Let's just change a few of these lines right now. Instead of it now being a toss-up, it's now going to be a lean, slightly Republican. And so, it was a purposeful act. Would they have done it if they didn't have to fix the bad district? No, they would not have. But it was an opportunity that the Republicans saw, and it's like, you know, rather than us spending millions of dollars, let's help ourselves out here a little bit. And, you know, by, you know, shifting a few lines, it was not the most major line change that happened, but it basically was a district that would have become Republican probably by 2030. They just helped it be there by 2026. So the Democrats were going to lose that district anyway.
But that's been buried in the narrative, obviously.
Because unfortunately,
the president, you know, we all know, he says stuff. Sometimes when he says stuff, you know, even the supporters are like, oh no, don't do that. So when he said, oh good, thanks for, you know, drew me 5 new seats, it's like, oh no. So then it became Trump forced Texas to draw him 5 new seats, so we have to counter it. And that's pretty hard to refute because look how long it's taken us to unscramble all that. They just have a different setup in Texas than we do in California, and maybe we ought to let's take our break just a teensy bit early, and then when we come back, maybe explain the constitutional layout on the California side, and
let's do it.
Because they don't have any of that, so really we only have to tell one side of the story because there is only one side. We will come back. Our guest is Mark Moisher. We are talking about Proposition 50 that is on your ballot for November the 4th in California. And for those of you around the country who think Gavin Newsom might be a good president, you should watch this because, I have a theme song for him. How's that? You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Compliance. We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore. Need your compliance. Just give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore. No more self-reliance.
So, Gavin, the musical, you got 2 options there. I do think compliance hits the nail more on the head, though. So, Mark, Talk to us about the constitutional issues with Prop 50 here.
I'd love to, because I had two different lawsuits that I filed over the constitutional aspect here. Understand that the United States of America is not a democracy.
And a shockwave heard around the world.
California is not a democracy. And if you look at our California flag, what does it say underneath the bear?
Has that very difficult word republic in it.
Republic. Okay, we are a constitutional republic. What that means is that we have an agreement between the people and those who govern us, that we have given them the ability to govern us within the limitations of what we call the Constitution. Because if we were a democracy, what that would mean is that the will of the majority controls 100% of the time. And if we live in a democracy, then the Ku Klux Klan could just kill all African-Americans, and there would be no reputation, no harm, no foul, because, hey, we voted on it, right? Blacks can't vote, fine. But no, we live in a republic where there is limitation on the will of the majority. And so it's very important to go back and understand what is in our Constitution. And one of the very first provisions that was put in our current Constitution is that the legislature, before they are even allowed to have a hearing on a bill, they had to sit on it for 30 days. And the reason why they sit on it for 30 days is to allow the public the opportunity to see the introduced language and to decide whether or not they want to go up to Sacramento and let their voice be heard on this legislation that is going to eventually govern them. And so what does Gavin Newsom do? He introduces language on Monday, August 18th, and the committees hear that language on Monday, the 18th. They don't even wait 24 hours, let alone 30 days, before they are having hearings on this language. I mean, they just literally blow through the Constitution and just say, full speed ahead. What are some of the other provisions in the Constitution that Gavin Newsom has violated? Well, within our Constitution, there is a doctrine, and it's not spelled out black and white, but basically the doctrine is the legislature cannot do something that they are not authorized to do. And so since the Constitution specifically said that it is the duty of the Independent Redistricting Committee to draw the map, that means that the legislature did not have that authority. And so when the legislature drew an approved map, that is what's called an ultra vires activity. It is an activity that they did not have the authority to do. And since they did an activity that they were not authorized to do under the California Constitution, that act is unconstitutional, and thus what they voted on should never be enforceable. Now, there is another provision in our Constitution that says, redistricting occurs at, right after the census. That, the California Supreme Court has interpreted that as being that you cannot in California do a mid-decade redistricting. That is a famous case from the 80s. It's called Duke Mason versus the legislature. And the legislature did not like the redistricting. And a couple years in, They said, hey, what if we go to the people and ask for the people's permission so that way we could do a mid-decade redistricting? And the Supreme Court said, no, under our Constitution, redistricting can only occur once every 10 years. And sorry, but you're not allowed to you do a mid-decade redistricting. And so, I mean, there's another violation to our Constitution.
And we did do a redistricting after the last census, correct?
You could only do it immediately after the census, unless a court says that you drew the lines unconstitutionally, and then you're supposed to be able to redraw it. Well, there's never been a lawsuit over our line, so thus there had not been, you know, there was no opportunity for California to do a redistricting. Gavin Newsom doesn't care. He just does what he wants. He violates the Constitution. You know, another thing in our Constitution says that if you are drawing lines, you're supposed to keep communities of interest together. You're supposed to divide cities as few times as possible. You're supposed to divide counties the least amount of times as possible. You're supposed to keep communities of interest together. He just ignored all that. He just drew the lines the way that he wanted to draw the line because he doesn't care about this pesky little thing called the Constitution. As I have counted it, there are five major constitutional violations. And as such, I filed two different lawsuits with the California Supreme Court. And what the California Supreme Court did is they declined to hear the case. They did not actually rule on the merits. They just said, we're not going to get involved. You know, and basically they said to Gavin Newsom, do what you want. We are not going to enforce the Constitution. So where does that leave me? Well, I am preparing the next lawsuit. If the voters of California do pass this unconstitutional Prop 50, I will be filing a lawsuit on Wednesday after the election, and we're already talking to experts. We've already found where these maps violate the 14th Amendment, and we are preparing to file a lawsuit the very next day. And unfortunately, based upon what I am seeing right now, that lawsuit is going to be necessary because for whatever reason, Democrats are extremely excited to get out there and stick it to Donald Trump, and Republicans are just not voting. It's very sad to see, but Republican and independent voters apparently do not understand that they need to be voting no on Prop 50, and they're not returning their ballots, and the Democrats who want to stick it to Donald Trump are just racing to the polls and turning in their ballots at record numbers. So unfortunately, unless we can turn this around and start getting people to vote no on Prop 50, I'm going to be busy for the rest of this year preparing lawsuits.
Well, and the crazy part is you have a lot of people who disagree with this, but then they'll say it doesn't matter. They're just going to do what they're going to do. And it's like, and then, you know, what I've handled a lot of the text messages for the volunteer on the volunteer side for No on 50, and you know what about the Epstein files? It's like, okay, that's random. And you know, when are you going to stop voter fraud? It's like, I've got an idea. Let's work on that while we vote and keep Gavin Newsom from ruining the state. Maybe we could do both.
Maybe
like simultaneously.
So your lawsuit. Let's assume or let's pretend that 50. Does pass, you file your lawsuit. Will that lawsuit, is that going to be in time to keep 50 from being enacted?
That is a great question.
Go Bill.
And what this is probably more of an education than most of your voters or listeners will care to have, but there's a federal law that when you deal with congressional districting, it goes straight to what's called a three-judge panel. So we will be filing a lawsuit getting what's called a three-judge panel. Hmm. We will be asking the court for what's called a temporary restraining order from stopping Prop 50 from going into effect. And for an order on a preliminary injunction, which means our case is so solid that there, it doesn't, you know, we, even before we get to all the evidence, the court should issue an injunction stopping Prop 50 from going into effect, because we are most likely going to be the prevailers of this action in the long run. And so let's keep the status quo. Let's not let the map change. And so that's called the preliminary injunction. We are going to be asking the court to enter a preliminary injunction by Thanksgiving, so that the losing side has the ability to take it to the Supreme Court, and for the Supreme Court to make a decision on what we, as lawyers, call the rocket docket. There would not be oral arguments in the Supreme Court. It would just be a decision on the merits, on the papers, that we would be asking the Supreme Court by December 19th to issue an order stopping the new map from going into effect until the case is fully litigated. And so what that would mean is that if the Supreme Court were to issue what's called a stay pending appeal, the court would say, okay, Prop 50 maps are not going into effect. Now go litigate these Prop 50 maps, put forth all your evidence, bring forth all your testimony, let the three-judge panel hear all the evidence, and after they make a decision, and then we go through the appellate process, then, you know, then we'll decide whether the Prop 50 maps are, were unconstitutional or not, or whether, or whether we have to keep the old or new. And so that is kind of the legal process. You do not get a full adjudication in 6 weeks. So the early process will be just about the injunction. Should the Prop 50 map be enjoined from going into effect while we litigate the issue? And so that's going to be the fun stuff that we'll be doing between the 5th and Christmas. And then after, you know, if the injunction is granted, then we'll probably be litigating the map sometime next summer.
Yeah, and it would just be so much, not to try to put you out of a job, but I know there's plenty to do, so you won't be bored. But wouldn't it be nice if the voters just rose up and said, no, thank you. Like, we see what you're doing, and this is silly and crazy. And no, just no. That would see that the thing is, you can, we can sue this stuff down, but I think sometimes people miss the human element. You know, the legislature, if they are not forced back by the voters, it just tells them, we'll just,
we can do whatever we want.
Yeah, we can do whatever we want, and yeah. And so there is, you know, there is much to blame as a lot of my one of my text guy, you know, messages that came back said, I will vote against anything Mussolini wants. And I was like, Mussolini, that's funny. I like that. That was new
well,
for me.
I'm calling the Prop 50 map the Gavamanders. They're
right.
Not gerrymandered, they're Gavamanders.
And you have a really good video on that, by the way, and it's linked on the Shasta GOP page, but I will put it on the page for today. Because it does explain it well. It's really helpful, actually. And I just think that the voice of the voters is the most important. And honestly, don't take for granted that your friends, your relatives, your neighbors, your coworkers, like the people you come in contact with, the banana guy at the grocery store, you know, I mean, ask people, like, hey, do you know about this? Don't assume that they do, and ask them if they're, you know, are they voting? Your neighbors, if they don't get out that much or they're afraid to mail in their ballots, California, you can ballot harvest. And what that means is you could turn in someone else's ballot. You could literally go door to door in your neighborhood and say, hey, I'm going down to the registrar of voters. Want me to take your ballot for you? There are many, many things we can do, and you don't have to be a professional to do it. It's going to take all of us to open our mouth and turn out the voters. If they don't want to mail it, great. Drop it off at the registrar or go to the polls. But just you got to show
you
up.
You got to vote.
You
yeah.
got to show up. And so whether or not you love the system, you think it's rigged, you think they'll cheat, blah, 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 make it tough. While we're working on all of that, you still, gosh, you got to show up.
You got to show up. And, you know, the thing is, this is, Gavin keeps calling this temporary. Well,
yeah.
Here's what's going to happen. If this passes, what stops them in 2032 when they go, you know what, we don't like the map that the commission did. We think we could do a better job. Well, the politicians will just you know, send it to the voters and we'll do it again. And, you know, the people who work the commission, they're volunteers.
Yeah, and this just tells them they wasted their lives. I mean, how horrible.
Yeah, so if the politicians can just change it whenever they want.
Yeah, what's the point?
Who's going to do the commission?
Yeah,
it's like
no one.
Why even bother?
Mark, we have run up against it. And it looks like Alan is here, so you are free to go about your day. And we will have you back before Prop 50 hits the ballot box to do a little bit more.
Thanks for explaining all that, because it needs to be explained to people.
Bottom line, you don't vote. Here's what happens.
Yep.
We'll
just
be right back.
Your rights.
Second half of We the People Radio here on October the 12th, 2025. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff.
And we have Alan Gelso with us. Yay. I read the snippet about his books some time back, and I thought, we have to cover this. And I'm positive he can't do this in a minute and a half, so we have an entire hour minus commercial, little commercial breaks, but the title of the book, actually, is The Golden Thread, A History of Western Tradition, and it's a two-volume set. I believe it is a textbook. He is the Thomas W. Smith Distinguished Research Scholar in the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions, and a faculty member at Princeton University. He's the co-author of this new textbook, The Golden Thread. I just think that this is something, the timing is so great. And the title of the article that was sent to me said, "Why are Americans ignorant of our own history?" And I thought, amen, right?
Yeah.
Let's get him on there. And then I searched for some pictures, as I told you last week, and I found this one wearing a dashing red tie and kind of a smirk. So, Alan, the picture I'm looking at of you has a little smirk on it, and I understand last week you were moving. I'm sure your smirk was gone by the end of that ordeal.
Well, I'm surprised that I would smirk. Usually I'm a pretty sober-looking character.
I know. That's why I picked the smirky one. You kind of look a little bit like Kelsey Grammer. It's kind of that sort of smirk.
Oh, dear. If I had a dime for every person who has asked me over the last 30 years, "Do you know that you look like Fraser?"
It's pretty funny. I mean, it's like, yikes.
I know, and I've had more than a few interesting events occur. Probably the most interesting was the day I walked into a news agency. I was going to buy a newspaper. The man behind the counter looked at me and said, "You're Fraser, aren't you?" And I said, no. And then he responded by saying, "Oh, I understand. You can't say that in public." and then he dived down below the counter and came up with a camera and took my picture.
Nice.
So suddenly I had celebrity thrust upon me.
I like it. Well, this, you know the Kelsey Grammer, like, kind of little half smile.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and this picture is that. And I thought, that is just fun. Especially for someone who wrote a book about the history of the world. I mean, I figured, well, you know.
The curious thing is, I've never met Kelsey Grammer. Maybe someone in your listening audience can broker some kind of rapprochement between us. But I've never met the man. And this makes it even stranger. I've never watched any of the shows that he has been in because I'm just not a television watcher.
Sure.
I wouldn't have the time.
Even if you're on the show,
Well, so to speak. So when people would say things like that to me, I wasn't entirely sure. Is that a compliment or an insult? Well, I finally figured out, all right, it's a compliment. So I'm reasonably content for people to ask me that question without biting anybody's head off.
Well, the good part is at least he's smart. I mean, it wasn't one of those comedies that was a bunch of, intestinal jokes or whatever. It's actually a very smart show, and it was very funny. But I just kind of chuckled because we interviewed a guy. His topic was very sober, too. He was a murder investigator, and there's a picture of him, and he looks like 007. And I was like,
oh my goodness.
I love knowing people just through their pictures on the internet. It's kind of fun.
It can be a little risky. You might draw the wrong conclusion.
I know.
If a photographer catches someone at the wrong angle or at the wrong moment, and that can send all kinds of shockwaves through the blogosphere.
Yeah, so I kind of go through the, just look at the preponderance of the pictures, and yours were very serious, but this one was fun, and I thought, we're fun, so you'll be fun, and this would be a good representation for this.
I will, as Jeeves said, I will do my best to give satisfaction.
Exactly. Okay, so is there an answer, or is it a two-volume answer to why are Americans ignorant of our own history? Did you ever get to the root of that?
I think we addressed that actually pretty frankly right at the very beginning in the introduction to the two-volume set. The two volumes were written by myself. Actually, I wrote the bulk of Volume 2. And Volume 1 was written by my co-author and friend of many, many years, James Hankins of Harvard. Hankins and I have known each other since, quite literally, since high school. And not only that, we were even in marching band together, believe it or not. So we have a long history over these five decades and more of constant conversation. And when someone asked me, how long did it take you two to write this? The answer was like, well, we've really been at this for about the last 50 years. So the actual mechanics of writing, maybe about 5 years. But the issues, the questions, all of these things are things we have talked about for all of those years. So what we have tried to address and had to address, both in the books and in our professional lives, is this question, why don't people know more about history? And I think there's several reasons for that. One is that there has occurred a crisis of sorts in this thing we call Western civilization. There's a kind of indifference. Because we have learned by means of mass communication, we've learned how big the world is, and we feel that we have to accommodate all of it to do justice to it. And in accommodating all the other histories that it's possible to accommodate, we have to make some room and shorten the attention span that's devoted to Western history and to American history in particular. Sometimes the indifference, though, is there because there are people who believe that all history is really just superstructure. It really isn't about real things like the acquisition of power or economic forces. And then there's sometimes, quite frankly, there are people who are just simply openly hostile to Western civilization, to American history in particular, within Western civilization, because they blame it for quite a grocery list of evils, genocide, colonialism, imperialism, slavery, racism, sexism, as though these were not present in other places, which of course they are. It's not that these are unique in the experience of Americans or in the experience of Western civilization. So I think in many respects, there are a multitude of reasons for this moment. when we feel like we have suffered from a kind of cultural Alzheimer's, and our memory has gone blank, or if not entirely blank, at least mostly blank, about the things that are really very important for us. So these two books are really a recall. They are a stimulation, a revitalization of our memory of who we are and how we got to where we are. And that's why we focus our title on one particular famous myth from Greek classical history. The golden thread is really about how Theseus finds his way out of the labyrinth after he has slain the evil Minotaur. The golden thread is what he finds as his passageway out of the labyrinth into the light of day. And what we are encouraging people to do through these books is, once again, find a way out of the darkness of the labyrinth into which we've allowed our memory to lapse, and follow that golden thread to the light, to the present, to our current situation, and bring with it all the riches of the past in terms not just of history, but also of culture, of literature, of art. These two books, these are big books. They're big because they're chock full of illustrative material, of art, of charts, of primary sources. In a sense, we want people to be able to dip into these books and have a sense that they are meeting their own civilization.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm always fascinated by history, and one of the things that I think people kind of lose sight of is when you talk about world history, I mean, written history goes back forever. Our history is only 250 years old. You go beyond that, and the things that were going on in the world prior, I mean, 1500, 1400, 1300, it's all written down. And we weren't
in the game.
We weren't even in the game. We weren't even thought of when all this was happening. And that always just kind of fascinates me when you put it in perspective.
Look at it in the long term, and we are still in what you might call, as a nation, our adolescence.
Yeah.
Sometimes with all the problems of adolescence. Adolescents don't have a particularly good grasp, let's say, on the experience of their parents. In fact, by the time you get to 14, 15, 16, 17, hey, you don't want to be seen doing the things your parents did. You really don't think that the experience of your parents is all that relevant to you and your friends.
Right.
Then you get a little bit older, you go to school, you acquire a life of your own, and as Mark Twain once said, it is absolutely amazing how much your parents have learned by the time you turn 22.
That is so true.
Yeah, they get smarter as you get older.
They really get smarter.
Yeah. So in this case, what we are in is a kind of intellectual adolescence. And what these books are a way of doing is helping us get to the mature stance that understands exactly how we got where we are today, and what we have gained by it, and also what we've lost along the way, and can and should retrieve. So these books are a guide cast in the form of history, of two volumes worth of history, because both Hankins and I are historians, professionally speaking. But it's also a recovery of the whole notion of what it is to be part of a civilization. And simply unpacking the word civilization gives us some fairly good ideas of what is contained in that effort.
Well, who and where will this, where will your textbook, is it an option for, you know, universities? I realize people can actually, regular people that aren't in college can buy it, but...
Yeah, in large measure, Hankins and I have aimed the books themselves for students in upper division high school surveys, AP surveys of various sorts, maybe 11th if they're really, really good, but 12th grade, or for first-year college surveys. and we've already had inquiries from colleges and universities who are thinking about adopting the Golden Thread for Western Civilization survey courses. So that is the audience that we're really looking at, although, truth be told, these are the kind of books that could really be picked up by almost anyone. You don't have to be 18, 19, 20. You can be two or three times that and still pick these books up and find elements of interest in the narrative, in the excerpts from the original sources, in the artwork that is reproduced here and discussed, even the discussion of music. Now, in a book, you can't play music, but in a book, you can describe music. So, for instance, in Volume 2, I have separate sections talking about Claudio Monteverdi, talking about Giovanni Gabrieli, about Tchaikovsky, about Brahms, about Wagner. I devote, in fact, a whole chapter to the individual whom I consider the greatest of Western musicians in anything remotely related to modern times, and that is Johann Sebastian Bach. So all of these things are in these books, and they are there for anyone at any age level to access. So art, music, and the historical narrative, these are all combined in these volumes.
I think, honestly, I think it's really worth hitting home the fact that we have lost track of some of our history, and some of it is, well, I'll be kind. How about it's not being taught accurately? There's a little bit of that going on, a lot of that going on, which is sparking all sorts of revolutionary ideas that aren't really revolutionary. They're just kind of based on lack of historical knowledge. Maybe we can hit that when we come back. Sorry, I just looked at the time. We have to take a really quick break, but we're going to be back with Alan Gelzo and the books that he has written with James Hankins, The Golden Thread, A History of Western Tradition, of the Western Tradition. And stick with us. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
It's our time to take a stand. Remember who we are.
Remember who we are.
There's a call across this land. Remember who we are.
Remember who we are.
We were a city on a hill, a candle in the dark. It started long ago. Now we have come so far. We keep our faith, and there's no price to be free. Remember who we are. With our blood, sweat, and tears, remember who we are. Will our children be the ones asking us one day why we didn't do enough, why we gave it all away?
So your book might not have any music in it, but we found some. And
well, that worked. There's a message there, and the message is who we are is who we were.
Yeah.
And a sense of understanding that is critical to the life of any society. I remember many years ago, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in his great opus, The Gulag Archipelago, made the comment that the first strategy of tyrants and dictators is to erase the history of the people that they conquer.
Yep.
Because then people have nothing to compare the past and the present with. They have no way of looking at their current situation and saying, look, this is wildly different and much worse than it was in the past. And if you don't have that as a guide, if you don't have that as an incentive, then you're not going to trouble the waters for the tyrants and the dictators who are ruling you. And that's, of course, exactly what the tyrants and dictators want. They want to erase the past because it gives you no basis of comparison for understanding your situation in the present.
Yes, and I would imagine it's very difficult since you've spent so much time caring about and researching and documenting all of these things. It's probably pretty tough to watch the conclusions that some of our, especially college-age students, have found with communism and all of those things. It's like,
oh yeah, yeah.
Like you want to just bang your head on a table. It's like, have you never read anything? What the heck?
Well, sometimes the answer to that question is no, they haven't.
sometimes it's right in front of our face, isn't it?
Right. But let me take a step beyond that. That's sort of a knee-jerk response. I want to be perfectly frank and say that there are things that have happened in the experience of the Western nations, which is to say Europe, the United States, and all of the, let's call them the appendages of European civilization, Australia, New Zealand, South America. There are things that have happened in the life of just the last century and two decades that are pretty nasty affairs. Two world wars, some shameless exploitation. And in that respect, it's no wonder that guilt and pity play such a large role in the way people are educated today and are instructed to be ashamed of the past of their own cultures. And so it's not difficult to come up with a bill of indictment. You can put a lot of things on it, all the way from the Western Front in 1914 to 1918, to atomic bombs in World War II, to the concentration camps and the Holocaust, to the Gulag. And you can look at everything that's happened in the last 100, 120 years, and you could say, goodness sakes, this thing called Western civilization really looks like a crock. So if people are disenchanted, there are some good reasons. On the other hand, in the past of Western civilization, there have also been moments of great loss when it looked like the whole thing was going to come apart. When the Roman Empire collapsed, it really seemed at that moment that everything that had gone into the making of the Western tradition, which is to say the civilization of the Greeks, the civilization of the Romans, was going to be hopelessly lost. And in fact, we did lose large chunks of it. But we managed to get by, as Kenneth Clark remarked many years ago, by the skin of our teeth. We recovered those elements of civilization that were so close to being lost. All right, that was one occasion. Another occasion was after the Great Plague of the 14th century, which costs the life of something like two-thirds of the European population. And we talk about a pandemic, and we talk about people getting shots and masks. Well, there weren't shots, and there weren't masks, and the bubonic plague was infinitely more deadly than COVID. That was a moment when, once again, Western civilization seemed just to teeter on the brink of dropping into the abyss. Mm-hmm. And we almost did it again 300 years later, with the religious wars of the 17th century, and especially the great 30 Years' War, when it seemed like everyone had forgotten what it was to be civilized and was behaving like barbarians. So there have been these moments in the past, but we have recovered from them. And we are looking at a moment when, yes, there has been, over the last century, a lot of the same loss. But we can recover this again, and it is important for us to recover the great things of Western civilization, because the alternative to civilization, quite literally, is barbarism. And do we want to be ruled by something we would call barbarism? I would define barbarism fundamentally as the worship of power.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have to, if you have to characterize that worship of power, what it involves in is total loss of self-control. Everyone just behaves according to impulse, and usually very destructive impulse. There's the development of destructive religions, sometimes anti-religions, and we can see this as an aspect of barbarism. Another way that you can talk about barbarism is about illiteracy. Illiteracy, and with illiteracy, indifference to the past. Because what else is literacy but a way of holding off indifference and loss of memory of the past? That's why we write things down. Because you and I can't remember everything. And even the things we do remember are going to perish with us. Why do we write things down? Because we want the things that are written to endure. But barbarism takes that as an enemy and destroys it.
Right.
And I think above all, barbarism looks a certain way. Barbarism looks ugly. It's ugliness in art, it's ugliness in literature, it's ugliness in music, it's ugliness in architecture.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things fundamentally are based on a worship of power. And that's what constitutes barbarism. Is that what we want to live under? I don't think so.
No.
So if we want to escape the appeal of barbarism, and the appeal of barbarism is out there, all you got to do is look out the window, mm-hmm. and you can see the examples of the threat of barbaric thinking. If we want to avoid being ruled by barbarism, then the alternative is civilization, at which point you want to say, all right, tell us about civilization. That's what these two books are about.
Do you think, you talk about these periods of great loss. Do you think civilization needs to go through those periods of great loss in order to kind of regroup and come back stronger and better?
That would almost be like saying that it's good for a human body to go through cholera, smallpox, and malaria in order to become stronger.
Right, right. Heart pass. But we continue to do it.
Well, yes, but we don't do it as a plan. We don't say, okay, we're 12 years old. Now, here's smallpox. This will be good for you, whether you like it or not. That's really not what we do. We understand that there are better ways to live, and especially when we think about what it costs to make a comeback. I mean, on the one hand, yes, you can say it's a remarkable feature of the Western tradition that it has the kind of resilience that allows it to stage these recoveries. That's really remarkable in its mm-hmm. own right. But the price that gets paid along the way, that's not something you want to invite. You might want to say, I'm not sure I want to endorse it, but you might want to say, well, this is inevitable. Everything goes through this kind of cycle. Yes, perhaps, but even if you grant the legitimacy of talking about cycles in history, it's not a pleasant thing that you want to invite on people. And above all, what if the cycle goes off the rails? What if, in fact, the cycle becomes so destructive that the civilizational values themselves, this time, get completely lost?
Right.
That's not a chance you want to take. It's not an era that you want to live through.
No, that's an excellent point. You know, you hear people talk about, they think they have it terrible right now, which I have a hard time with. But, we're going to go through another civil war. We need another civil war to get this straightened out. Where's that come from? I mean, it was so destructive. I mean, we're still feeling the effects of the last civil war, and yet people want to go through that again. How do you explain that?
Well, I think sometimes it's because they're trying to think of the most readily available cataclysm that Americans have experienced. And the one that pops up most easily on the screen is the Civil War. They might just as easily say the Great Depression or the First World War. But they come up with the Civil War because that's what comes up most readily.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to have another Civil War? I'm very dubious about this. at least we're not going to have a civil war in the same sense that we had it in 1861.
Right. No, there's right. no way.
Yeah, we're not marching around with single shot muzzle loading muskets that fire black powder. That's not going to happen.
Well, every person who ever tells me that, I finally stopped having the, you know, getting into the weeds on, you know, what the mechanics, and I just cut right to the chase. Okay, let's agree we're having it. Starts tomorrow. What's that look like?
Most of the time we couldn't say.
And then the silence ensues, and the debate is over, and they realize, we're probably not doing that.
Right. It sounds profound to talk about. It even sounds impressive, but is there any substance in it? No. Now, having said that, is it possible we would go through a period of great political disruption? Now, that's another story.
Yeah.
And that becomes a possibility that we all have to think about and we all have to cope with. I think fundamentally, the American imagination is so thoroughly wedded to this idea of democracy, is so thoroughly wedded to its constancy and its survival, that I don't think Americans are going to cheerfully throw that away and say, simply because I disagree with my neighbor, ergo, I'm going to draw an international boundary line around the backyard. That is not going to happen. That is not, it's not practicable, and it's not even really feasible.
So how do you explain this shift in our political landscape towards socialism? When you look at the history of socialism, communism, whatever you want to call it, it always fails. And yet we have so many people that are willing to look at that and
their answer is always, didn't do it right.
Yeah, we'll do
we
it.
We can do it a different way.
Right, so another million casualties.
Right.
It's going to sound peculiar for me to put it this way, but this is one of the casualties of historical ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Because what makes the communist alternative compelling to people? Is it because it has demonstrated great economic success? Right, sure.
Zero chance there.
Even if we say, all right, we're going to have it in a somewhat modified form, we're going to have the great socialist experiment. Fine, take a look at the great socialist experiments. Tell me how much great economic success there is. Now, people will sometimes pop up and say, yeah, but look at Britain, the National Health Service, everybody gets free health care. Well, yeah, everyone gets free health care approximately 3 months after they're dead.
Yeah.
So what exactly is it we're talking about? Why? It's not the practical results of socialism or communism that attract people. It's a theory of history. Because what else is Marx? I mean, everything else that Marx described in his writings that speaks to economics has failed. But one thing which abides, and that is the appeal of Marx saying, I know why historical change happens. Historical change happens because there's change in the economic forces at work in the lives of cultures and countries. What are the great markers, historically speaking? Well, there was feudalism, and then there was this bourgeoisie, this middle class, and the middle class overthrew feudalism and replaced it with capitalism. All right, what's going to happen next? The working class is going to overthrow the bourgeoisie and capitalism, and it's going to set up the socialist paradise. Of course, Marx never said what might happen after that, but what people have been enchanted by is this notion that Marx has given them the explanation for why things have occurred in the past and why they are going to occur in a certain pattern in the future. Fundamentally, economics is not what makes Marxism attractive, because there's been so many failures. What continues to make Marxism attractive is it offers to explain why events change in history. And they change because they change on the basis of economic forces and the movement of economic forces and economic classes. It is the enchantment, so to speak, of that historical vision, which keeps Marxism alive. even when they know very well that there's no economic substance, no economic theory, nothing that is going to guarantee the prosperity of people. To the contrary, it's not prosperity that they're after. What it is a sense of being on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm.
And given that as its attraction, people will embrace that. They will throw away the other histories of their nations and of their civilization to embrace the Marxist theory of history. If you would like to put Marxism in the refrigerator where it never needs to come out again, then the way to do it is to strike at it as a theory of history, as an understanding, as a way of explaining history, because that is the thing which keeps it alive.
Mm-hmm. How do you...
Because there is no free lunch.
No.
And so they're always promising all these things that...
Well, and everybody likes free stuff.
Are never coming.
Yeah, we're
going to do all these free things. And it's like, it always blows my mind that adults will fall for that. Because where in our lives is that even true? Oh my gosh, it's 1:41. Alan, you're causing us to time travel. I hope you're happy.
Well, that's sort of part of my job description.
That's where the smirk comes in. That's what's happening. We are experiencing that. All right, we've got to take another really quick break. We're going to come right back. Our guest is Alan Gelzo, and the book is not The History of the World Part 2, but that's what I hear in the back of my mind, The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition. And it's a two-volume set, and I think we should make everyone read it.
Yeah, it should be.
Let's talk
mandatory.
About freedom and force everyone to read a book. So, really quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Ah, yes. Until you delve into the details.
Yeah. Let me take off my rose-colored glasses here. I have a question. How do you see the, you know, with all this advanced technology that's coming on board, seems like daily we're hearing of new tech, how do you see that influencing or guiding the direction of our society?
So you want him to write a third book about the future?
No, but everything seems to be moving so fast right now. And I know every civilization and every era has its own technology. But I'm just curious with what we, you know, with the AI and computers and so forth, where do you see that guiding us?
Well, it's curious because as Robert Fulton's steamboat, the Clermont, was beating its way up the Hudson River at about 6 miles an hour, people on the deck of the Clermont were possessed with panic. We've never gone this fast before.
Yeah.
All right, 6 miles an hour, okay? At that point, that was what really seemed to be almost impossible for people to achieve, much less to be able to continue to breathe. And yet we got over it pretty quickly. Technological change has always been with us, especially it's been with us over the last 300, 400 years. And in particular, since the middle of the 19th century, with the development of the electrical telegraph, we have moved more and more and more towards electronic-based innovations. And we will continue to do that. They will disturb us at moments, the same way they disturbed, the same way the electrical telegraph disturbed people when it was introduced, when the telephone was introduced only a few decades after that. But when you lit up cities with the incandescent light bulb, that was disturbing in its own right. Yet at the same time, we learn how to accommodate and work around these things. Is there going to come a moment in the development of technology today when we are not able to, when the technology finally defeats us? I think that is going to require more of a prophet than I am to say, because there's a good deal in the world of modern technological developments which is very problematic. Look at the amount of time people devote to screens, especially adolescents,
mm-hmm.
and look at the damage it does. The studies that have been done about the rates of anxiety and depression that are generated by kids who are glued to their smartphones all the time, this is serious and it's disturbing. Is it, however, the end of an age? That, I think, remains to be seen. We have encountered extraordinary technologies before, and they've changed tremendous amounts in short periods of time in people's lives. But we have found ways of accommodating those changes, and we found ways of internalizing coping mechanisms for them. So if we've done that in the past, all right, let's wait and see. We may find exactly those ways for the future. That is as much as a peek behind the curtain of the future as I think anybody can decently give. Otherwise, a great deal of this becomes doomsaying. Because doomsaying gets more attention. If I tell you that tomorrow everything is going to be cool, are you going to sit up nights worrying about it? Are you going to do something about it? No. But if I tell you that tomorrow there's going to be an electromagnetic pulse that's going to fry up every piece of electronic equipment on planet Earth, you are going to do things, and probably you're going to buy things that I tell you to buy. There's much more of a profit margin to doom than there is to peace. This is why people peddle doom much more vigorously than they peddle peace.
Oh, sure. I look at, when you talk about the smartphone technology, I think part of the reason people aren't as educated in history in the past is they don't have to be. They can pick up their cell phone and they can, if somebody asks them a question, you know, they can look it up. AI will tell them the answer in seconds, you know, so.
It'll be the wrong answer, but.
yeah, but they won't know that.
Well, this is true.
and ignorance is bliss, volume 3.
But I think that's where I think it's, I don't want to say dumbing down, but I think that's exactly what's happening to a lot of our society, and particularly our younger generation.
I'm going to push some chips on the table and say Alan concurs.
Yeah.
Well, let me put it this way. Is it not strange that today we have, simultaneously, this extraordinary obsession with technology and technological development, at the same time as we have a real loss of belief and confidence in science?
Yes.
So that you have theories of science which completely subvert any notion of predictability, any notion of regularity. I can get into the weeds on some of this. I can drop names like Heisenberg and Thomas Kuhn and people like that. It's the sort of thing that provoked the response from Einstein, that his protest, God does not play with dice. And yet, all of our notions of science today and philosophy of science seem to be marching away from any confidence or belief at the same time as we're putting all our chips in the development of various kinds of technology. And of course, now all the current craze is for AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it's like any generation that is confronted with new technology. It is a little frightening,
all the more reason to come back to this idea of picking up the golden thread.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Of the Western tradition. I mean, and we use, by the way, we use the word tradition rather than civilization, because the Western tradition is really a collection of civilizations. You might think of it as kind of archaeological layers. So there is a Greek civilization that we begin with the Battle of Marathon. And then piled on top of that, absorbing that, is the Roman civilization. Then on that, the medieval civilization. Then on that, the civilization of the Enlightenment, and so on. So there is a tradition, because all of these civilizations work together as layers in the creation of this tradition. And I think it's important that we recover that as a counterbalance to the obsession with technology, to the threat of barbarism, because what this Western tradition does is it puts us back to language and literature, puts us back to the written word, it puts us back to decision-making, to what's sometimes called the argument for the sake of heaven. It puts us back to government and law and the impulse for freedom, and it puts us back to faith and art, and above all to resilience, because the great thing about this Western tradition over and over again at its moments of crisis is the capacity that it has shown for self-criticism and for renewal. And it's building on that capacity for self-criticism, of acknowledging, yes, in the Western past, in the American past, there have been some dreadful mistakes. There have been some embarrassing, dreadfully embarrassing moments. Nevertheless, over and over again, our capacity for self-criticism has allowed us to turn those moments of embarrassment, of almost self-contradiction, into forces for the good. So take all those things together, and this Western tradition is something that we need in an environment when barbaric attitudes, the worship of power, mm-hmm. and the obsession with technology threaten to overwhelm us. That is why the Western tradition, we have the imperative here to recover its strengths and its virtues, because it is that which time and again in the past have rescued us from the abyss and can rescue us again from an abyss of the worship of power and the obsession with technology. So that's why these books are here, to help us along the path of that golden thread.
I think, and here at the end of what we got from Stephen Manfredi, your publicist, he just always finds us the most amazing people. People ask all the time, where do you find all these people? I'm like, I don't. I just have friends. Viva la friends. So this, he says here, as Gelzo and Hankins conclude, this indeed is the great test that Western civilization faces in our time. We need to find a new balance between tradition and innovation, to modernize with moderation without losing that inheritance of immeasurable value that we call the Western tradition. And it's like, yes, that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think that is something that rings true, would ring true for most people, and yet so much of it has become, it's like the addiction to noise.
I think that if people could sometimes sample the extraordinary products of a great Italian chef, they would suddenly say, why haven't I ever had a dinner like this before?
Mm-hmm.
Or if they were to sample some marvelous French wine, they would say, why have I never encountered something like this before? I think they could do the same thing by encountering the literature of great writers and the art of great artists and the music of great musicians from the Western past. A lot of the times we're scared to do that. If I were to tell you that I'm going to give you an assignment from Boccaccio's Decameron, you would probably think, oh my goodness, I'm going to get a quiz on this tomorrow morning at 9:00. How am I ever going to cope with it? Because that stuff is so highbrow and I am so lowbrow, I could never hope to scale the cliff. Well, you know something? If you pick up the Decameron, I'm just using that as one example from the 14th century.
Mm-hmm.
You pick up a good translation of the Decameron, I guarantee you in 10 minutes you'll be hooked by the thing. Why? Because Boccaccio was writing it for people just like you. He wasn't writing it for professors.
Yeah.
He wasn't writing it for people coasting along at the 30,000 foot intellectual level? No, because there really aren't that many people there. But Boccaccio is writing this as a chronicle of what he went through. And the same thing is true of all the great writers. The great literature that Hankins and I examine in these books and offer you examples from, they're really like those small samples of great dishes that you might get at a fair, let's call it a restaurant fair. You go there and the restaurants have these little samples of the best cooking that they offer. All right, that's what these books are. We're going to give you the best samples of the Western tradition. And what you're going to find is, hey, this stuff was written for us. Because yeah. It was.
Yeah, their audience was regular people. My mother was a professional cellist, and my mother believed that, and she was correct, that music spoke to everyone. You didn't need to know who the composer was. Like, my brother used to fall asleep all the time, and we were horrified because here we were sitting right below. She played first chair, and we were sitting right below the cello section, and here my brother's out cold. And she just always smiled, and she said, he's enjoying it in his own way. And so, you know, musicians see that, historians see that, and I think sometimes we don't spend enough time with all of you.
Well, I think sometimes those of us who are part of the professoriate sometimes make more grief than we need to. Sometimes what we really have to do is remember that what we're doing is we're introducing strangers to each other. Mm. We're introducing people today to people they've never met from the past. And if you were in a position like that, if you were about to introduce to, you know, someone who lives down the hall or next door, someone, let's say, from perhaps Nepal, if you were going to introduce to one of your neighbors, how would you go about doing it?
Yeah.
And as soon as you put it that way, that's really the task that Hankins and I have set for ourselves in this book. How do we introduce you to a treasure? If I were to tell
Alan,
you,
I hate to unceremoniously end our chat, but the radio is going to do it for us. But I really do want to pick this up and do this again because there's so much more to discuss, and we really appreciate you. The Golden Thread, the History of Western Tradition. You can find all the information about our guest and the book at WeThePeopleRadio.us.